Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Bubalo, and I'm the Deputy Director and the Research Director here at the Lowe Institute. Welcome to today's talk. The title of today's talk is North Korea in Crisis Again. Is it really different this time? In fact, the world has become so crisis-prone that you almost have a situation where each crisis is competing with the other for attention. You could almost see the leadership in Tehran and in Pyongyang kind of plotting, oh, those Iranians have grabbed the attention again. It's time for us to arc up. In recent weeks, it has indeed been North Korea that has hit the headlines for a variety of reasons that we will explore today. Chief amongst them, though, are concerns that North Korea is moving closer to its cherished goal of being able to launch a nuclear weapon from North Korea to a target in the United States. And as North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile testing regime has gathered pace, so has concern around the region about those tests. So it's great that we have two experts in-house here at the Lowe Institute to explore some of these issues, which we will do in our normal in-conversation style here at the Institute. To my left, to my extreme left, we have Dr. Ewan Graham, who is the International Security Program Director here at the Lowe Institute. Ewan has been a close observer of East Asian strategic affairs for more than 20 years. He was also a former analyst with the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office and served for a short while as chargé d'affaires at the British Embassy in Pyongyang. Not many people have that on their CV. And then we have, to my left, Dr. Jiyoung Sung. Jiyoung is let's say, indulging one of her hobbies today. Normally, she heads up our migration and border policy program, but she is also a leading regional expert on Korean affairs and is herself from South Korea. Jiyoung is a global ethics fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. She's also an associate fellow at Chatham House. And it's great that both of them can join us today to discuss this important issue. Please join me in welcoming Ewan and Jiyoung. So I want to pose a question to both of you first. It's the question that is in the title of our talk today. Why now? Why has North Korea again hit the headlines? Why is it again something that's taking up a lot of attention, taking up a lot of policy-making attention? Maybe I'll start with you, Ewan.
Sure. Well, April is, in the North Korean calendar, always a busy month. There's normally a spike of tensions around parades and internal anniversaries that are held. But I think we can trace the line back a little bit further. I think the big structural shift here is that the Trump administration has come out of the block so strongly on North Korea. Why? Well, one of the last things that the Obama administration did, bowing out, was to give a briefing, a handover briefing. And clearly one thing that registered very strongly in President Trump, then-elect President Trump's mind, was the importance of North Korea getting closer to this nuclear-tipped missile goal. So I think there's a genuine concern. It's not one that's manufactured or specific only to the Trump administration. The Obama administration was also, I think, becoming increasingly concerned that North Korea was getting closer to that goal. And of course, the pace of testing has increased. Last year, we saw a surprising gap after Kim Jong-un had done a lot of these ballistic missile tests and nuclear tests. Between, I think, August and February, there was no flight test of a ballistic missile. But from February until now, we've actually had 12 this year. So the pace has really ratcheted up again.
How would you assess the state of the Korean ballistic missile program at the moment? I mean, it seemed to be in some of the tests this year that the North Korean missiles were blowing up quite short of their target. I mean, where would you place them technically in terms of the aims of the program?
Given the limited constraints available to a country like North Korea, they've come on remarkably well. That it tells a story within a story that actually the economic situation is better than a lot of people realize. And there are those resources now able to be delivered into those programs. Normally, there is a sort of set choreography to this. North Korea holds a parade. In that parade, ballistic missile and other medium-range systems are showcased before they're flight tested and operationally deployed. In April, we saw a whole new range of systems that were brought out, at least the launchers. We don't know whether the real missiles were inside those launchers or not. But they're normally pretty good at following up on those with flight tests. And we've seen a rather concerning improvement in their success rate with a new type of system tested, an intermediate range ballistic missile that could reach Guam. So the point about reaching the United States, Guam is the United States. So if we're talking about the continental United States, we're still some way off from that. Just yesterday, a new potential anti-ship ballistic missile was tested. That is maneuverable. Again, it's a sort of cheap man's version of what the Chinese have been developing. But I think we've all learned not to underestimate their capabilities.
Jiyoung, what about you? Why do you think this is now sparked up now?
Why this is now? South Korea had an election after the impeachment of the previous President Park Geun-hye, and we had a presidential election on the 10th of May last month. And North Korea is trying to sway the politics in South Korea to influence the new president's policy toward the North. But we tend to forget that two Koreas are technically at war since the end of the Korean War, because the war didn't end with a peace treaty, but with the armistice. So technically, the two Korea has been at war for the past more than 60 years.
So what are the North Koreans hoping? Are they hoping that by firing a few missiles, they'll make the South Koreans more submissive? Or won't it have the opposite effect that will make them them closer to the US?
I did my PhD on North Korean propaganda, North Korean thinking, why they're doing this nuclear missile test, and why they're doing all this provocation against the international community, and especially its neighbor in the south, in Japan. For them, it's self-defense. Without nuclear weapon, they think they cannot survive in this very hostile international environment. Without nuclear weapon, it will be another failed state, like poor, nasty British regime somewhere in Northeast Asia. So having these weapons and having this tension in the Korean Peninsula is the only way for them to survive in the international community.
I wanted to focus on that a little bit more. I mean, you and you mentioned that this may signal that the economic situation is a bit better than people think. I mean, to both of you again, what does this what do these tests tell us about what's happening within North Korea at the moment? You and some of you again.
I completely agree with what Jiyoung said, that there is a survival element to this. The North Koreans look across the world. They look at what happened to Saddam Hussein, what happened to Muammar Gaddafi, and they draw the obvious conclusion that because they didn't have nuclear missiles, they ended up 6 foot under the ground. So there's that. But I think we neglect the internal element to this at our peril. That's the hardest thing to do, but I think there is a key domestic element to what Kim Jong-un is doing. The nuclear program dates all the way back to his grandfather, Kim Il-sung. Kim Jong-il then made it his own and increased the sort of the official commitment to it, but it was never part of the constitution. Kim Jong-un, when he came in, actually made it a formal goal. So there's no moving back from it. In that sense, it's much more difficult for him now to give up that nuclear guarantee. But it's not just about the external security environment. I think it's also about the internal jockeying that's still going on. Kim Jong-un has been 5 years in the role. He's proved smarter in many ways than people thought. He's been brutal about the way that he's taken out his rivals, but it's on a much more compressed time frame than his predecessor, his father. And I think we can conclude from that the attachment to the nuclear and ballistic missile programs, and he goes to these tests personally. I mean, he actually has photographs taken with all of the soldiers, even the unsuccessful launches. I mean, it's a wonder how North Korea gets by without any functioning government in a way, because Kim Jong-un, for better or for worse, is clearly prioritizing the missile and nuclear programs. But I think that's also his way of keeping his head above water for what is actually politically a very unstable environment, economically less so. That's the sort of paradox of the new North Korea.
Mm. What about you, Jim? How do you see this in terms of reflecting what's happening in North Korea?
I mean, to me, Kim Jong-un is not North Korea. North Korea is also composed of other elites and other components, economic and military components. It is probably our mistake to just focus on Kim Jong-un only or his family, but also there are Pyongyang elites who all have the vested interests in keeping the regime and having this provocative, more militarily adventurous regime.
Right. When we talk about the missile program, who is it aimed at? And Jiong, I'd like to start with you. I mean, how do South Koreans view the threat from North Korea? And how do they view these tests and the nuclear developments?
That's a very good question. I think South Koreans are all sort of numbed in their security senses because there have been just too many fights, too many provocations. Whenever they shoot something to the sky, most South Koreans will consider that it's what they do, what North Koreans do. So we are a bit numbed or immune to this sort of North Korean provocation for many, many years. So when they did, we all understood that it was a political, military gesture to this new president who'd like to inherit from Sunshine Policy. It was a policy by the late president Kim Dae-jung, which is about pro-engagement and opening more economic and cultural exchanges with North Korea. But so this, series of nuclear or missile tests is a gesture by the North to see the South Korean reaction, especially this new, more friendly policy toward North Korea.
That's an incredibly stoic reaction by society, given it must be one of the few in the world now that lives, literally in the shadow of a nuclear attack.
Yeah. Even some South Koreans are okay with North Korea having nuclear capabilities because they see once they're unified, it could be theirs. So rather than focusing on their capability or weapons capability, I think they try to see this as a sort of, as a fellow Korean, they have this scientific achievement by developing this very dangerous weapons. So it's a very dangerous idea, not just in the North, but also in the South. These right-wing, more militaristic people. It's a dangerous idea.
Mm-hmm. Bjorn?
I think previously it was possible to see the nuclear program as still a part of a bargaining chip approach. Kim Jong-il used it that way. North Koreans could be bought off, in effect, for slowing down their program. They always cheated on the side, but they genuinely would slow it down. Another big change for the worse is that Kim Jong-un, I think, has made a strategic decision that they want this capability fully rolled out. So in my view, I don't think they're interested in seriously talking until they've got that capability. And when they've got that capability, they'll make an announcement. At that point, they might start entering into talks with the United States about a freeze on some of those capabilities. But I think the important difference from North Korea of 15 years ago, or from the Iranian example, is the fact that their train is much further out the station. Mm. And I think the North Koreans want to get to that station first, and then that will be the new basis for their international relations base point position.
I want to come back to the policy options with both of you in a moment, but before we get there, other than being a threat to South Korea, I mean, the North Korean nuclear program, who else does it threaten in the region? I mean, there was a report a few weeks ago that, Australia was now in range of Korean ballistic missiles. Who are the people that worry most, and who are the people that should worry most about the North Korean program?
It gets back to why it's changed recently. The Trump administration is seized of this because, for the first time, North Korea is within spitting distance of a nuclear missile that can reach the continental United States and already can reach U.S. possessions in the Western Pacific. These sort of concentric circles are North Korea's way of internationalizing itself. It lacks any other kind of means to get international attention. So it's this question that I often receive, is North Korea irrational? Well, it's threat-based, so it sounds irrational because it's all about rattling people's cages, but that rattling serves a means to an end. It's their way of garnering attention. They're not suicidal. Therefore, a first use of those nuclear weapons is highly unlikely. but it is their main way of getting on the US agenda, and you'd have to say that they've succeeded in doing that, even at the cost of of facing a much more intense security situation. But that also serves their domestic ends. North Korea needs enemies, fundamentally. That's their chief. Bring the focus back to domestic politics. How do you justify the ban on movement, on freedom of information passing in? It's ultimately with reference to that external bogeyman, be it the United States, South Korea, or Japan. But those are the three key countries.
And what impact do you think this will have in the US, in the sense that you still get the sense that amongst the broader public, there is a general consciousness that the North Koreans are bad guys and they're regularly lampooned, but that it's less a threat to America directly? I mean, you even had, President Trump in South Korea grumbling about having to pay for the THAAD anti-missile system. But I would have thought things change once the North Koreans are able to demonstrate that they can actually fire a missile that will reach the United States.
Next week, the United States is to undertake its first ground-based mid-course interception of an ICBM. That has been fast-tracked because the threat of North Korean capabilities has really put that on the radar of the security community in the United States. But your point, I think, is also well taken, that this is something that does have the ability to register with ordinary Americans who have only been directly at threat from the Soviet Union and an inherited Russian capability and China. That's it. They're the only two countries who can directly threaten the United States by missile. So adding a third, a much more unstable regime to that without the means to invest in all those command and control capabilities that China and the Soviet Union have done. It's a rich man's game, nuclear deterrence. So let's not forget that is an important variable in this. But that, I think, for ordinary Americans will bring it very home. And it's something that, if we're looking at that domestic politics, if the Trump administration is in difficulty, there is also that possibility, the risk that plunging into an external crisis is one way to rally people around the flag.
I mean, the interesting thing is there's a whole generation of Americans who virtually grew up without that threat of nuclear war, after the end of the Cold War. So when we're thinking about policy options, what are the kind of options? I remember, people were debating the Iranian nuclear deal, the strongest argument was that all the other options, it was a bad option, but all the other options were worse. In this situation, it does seem that there are even fewer options. Take us through that, Ewan.
Yes. The United States has tried on previous occasions to put the genie back in the bottle. As I said, there is always an assumption that the North Koreans will continue some sort of program illicitly on the side. But that approach to putting the genie back in the bottle is very difficult now, given that we're on the verge of an operationally deployed nuclear capability. Perhaps not an ICBM, but certainly the shorter range and medium range missiles that they have. We haven't talked about the military option, but I mean, again, the reason why I think there was this attention spiked in international media is that a lot of people were wondering, is the United States going to seriously undertake preemptive or preventative strikes on the Korean Peninsula? There are no good options for doing that because the capability is now presumably dispersed, well protected. No guarantee, even if the United States were to do it, they'd be able to take out all those sites. So what does that leave? It leaves a deal. That's always politically odorous, difficult to sell to a skeptical American Congress, even if President Trump as the deal maker in chief wanted to do that. But the only option, I think, would be some sort of freeze, a freeze on missile testing, on nuclear testing. But I'm rather pessimistic that the North Koreans will do that before they've got their benchmark capability out in front.
I mean, one of the other countries, obviously, that is very concerned about that is Japan. And, I mean, do you see going forward the Japanese staying very close to the US in terms of discussing options for how to deal with this problem? Or is there a point at which the Japanese say, we have to go our own way? And people have talked about, for example, the Japanese developing their own nuclear deterrent.
I think the Japanese are increasingly uncomfortable. If you like, the glass half full is that the dynamics do favour some sort of deal. I think President Trump clearly signaled that when he said he would be honored to meet Kim Jong-un. The Chinese have long had a preference for the United States to get back into talks. The new South Korean government has made it clear that they want an engagement and a dialogue as the basis for the process. That leaves Japan as the outlier here. And we've already seen that the internal debate within Japan is now talking about acquiring not a nuclear capability, but a retaliatory conventional capability. And that's, I think, chiefly with North Korea in mind. President Trump tweeted yesterday that the North Koreans with their latest missile attack had embarrassed China. Well, actually, the Japanese, looking at that, will be scratching their heads and saying, well, it was headed up our way, not towards China. Why wasn't there a message of reassurance from the United States about that? So I think on the surface, Japan and the United States are still very much in lockstep. That's something that Prime Minister Abe has, I think, achieved a considerable success in building his personal relationship with Trump. But behind that, there are these longer-term questions about the US reliability. And the nuclear question is one that may eventually come back on. It would be the last option that Japan would do, but it can't be excluded.
Jiyoung, which brings us to South Korea's approach to all this. As you said, there's been an election and potentially the people are talking now about a change in approach. Yeah. Maybe before we talk about the change in approach, take us through a little bit of the history of the way that South Korea has approached North Korea in the past and what you see, and then what you see will happen in the future.
Sure. Before I answer that question, I think we tend to see North Korea as a threat to international peace and security. But to me, North Korea is a threat to itself. You know, when it's had a U.S. preemptive strike, it's gone. If North Korea does its strike first, then it will be retaliated and it will be gone. You know, anyway, so it knows that when it does a nuclear, when it uses nuclear weapons against its neighbors, then it's a suicide attempt. And now I can answer the questions about the South Korean policy toward North Korea. So before our last president, Park Geun-hye, who was also the first female president, but it ended with a tragedy. I think you all followed the news about how our president was impeached last time. Park Geun-hye represented the conservative approach to North Korea. So closing down the Kaesong Industrial Complex and also the joint tourist project in the East Coast. And before her, another conservative president, Lee Myung-bak, who also had a hawkish approach to North Korea. So we had two consecutive conservative governments who was not really in friendly terms with North Korea. But before that, we had another two consecutive progressive governments who had pursued pro-engagement policy toward North Korea. So before Lee Myung-bak, we had President Roh Moo-hyun, who committed suicide during the interrogation. Because his involvement in domestic politics and taking money from businessmen. And before Roh Moo-hyun, we had late President Kim Dae-jung, who was the pioneering president who imposed North Korea through engagement and economic and cultural exchanges. So we had a previous two conservative government and another two progressive government who completely had a different approach to North Korea. Mm. Now we had a president, Moon Jae-in, who was a chief of staff for President Roh Moo-hyun. So he inherited his policy toward North Korea from Roh Moo-hyun and Kim Dae-jung, who had a pro-engagement policy toward North Korea. So this new administration in South Korea will open access to North Korea. Will probably encourage South Korean businessmen going there, doing more businesses with North Korea, or open a new family reunion between South Korean and North Korean families, so that we have a totally new approach to North Korea now.
So what's the logic behind that approach? What's the logic of allowing South Korean businessmen to go to North Korea? How are they? How do they think that will shape or influence the North Korean regime? Mm.
So this new pro-North Korean engagement policy is originated from the Sunshine Policy during the Kim Dae-jung period. Sunshine Policy is from one of the Aesop fable, from the North Wind and the Sun. So there are two, the North Wind and Sun is competing for a man to take off his clothes So in this case, closed will be North Korea's nuclear program. So the north wind will blow as hard as he can so that the man can take off his clothes. The sun will shine, so it's warm, so the man will voluntarily take off his clothes. So sunshine policy is based on this Aesop fable. And eventually the sun will disarm or denuclearize North Korea. But now we have Moon Jae-in in Blue House in Seoul. So some pundits call his approach as a new sort of a renewed version of sunshine policy called moonshine policy. But the moon is not as bright as the sun. So the moon probably cannot take a man's clothes off. And we have a new man now. Back then we had Kim Jong-il as a head of North Korea. Now we have Kim Jong-un, a totally different man. This man now has a sort of a suicide bomb jacket. The clothes is different with the weapons. Lastly, nobody wants this man to survive. Everybody hates him. Probably they want him to freeze to death, to freeze the jackets and the man himself. So we have a totally different condition, compared to 10 years ago. So whether the moonshine policy will take this man's clothes off and denuclearize, I think that's probably more ideal than reality.
Is it effectively a policy of, well, he may or may not, take his clothes off or his take his jacket off, to extend the metaphor, but at the very least, we don't want to kind of scaring him into doing anything rash. In other words, it's a policy designed not to provoke the North Koreans, even if it's kind of realistic in the sense that it doesn't expect the North Koreans to, suddenly change.
Yeah, I think with South Korean, as a South Korean, I'm not a completely neutral person to comment on our policy toward North Korea, but we have a different interest from those of China or the U.S. For South Koreans, North Korea is an enemy because we are still at war technically. But also North Korea is an object to peacefully unify the country as one. We always think that we are the victims of these big powers by the Chinese, by the Americans, and perhaps Russian and the Japanese to some certain extent. We need to unify. That was a sort of lifetime mission during the Kim Dae-jung period. But Moon Jae-in has a totally new international environment and a new man in North Korea.
Can I just briefly add to that? I think it's important to understand the frustration that there is in South Korea, that they are constrained by these external power dynamics. North Korea's behavior, the United States, China, all of the big powers prevent it really from being able to dictate terms on the key security issue that affects it, North-South relations. There's no easy way around that. I think the North Koreans in some ways are actually tightening the belt around Moon Jae-in before the jacket can come off in the form of missile tests that have been three in his first 3 weeks. But that is important to understand that, the South Koreans and Moon Jae-in said this during his election, that he wanted to regain control to make South Korea, the center of North Korean policy. But their ability to do that is somewhat limited.
Mm. Both of you mentioned the kind of role of China here, and I wanted to explore that a little bit more. The Trump administration seems to be putting a lot of hope that, and I don't know how real it is, in the ability of China to somehow change North Korea's behavior, or at least to moderate it to some degree. And you mentioned Trump's tweet yesterday about how embarrassing this missile test was for the Chinese. I mean, realistically, what do you think the Chinese could do, and what do you think they're willing to do, Yuan?
Well, the Chinese, I think, genuinely, all things considered, wouldn't like to have an ally like North Korea on its doorstep for the obvious reasons. And they don't want a nuclear North Korea. So those broad goals are genuinely shared with the United States. But just because that is shared, it doesn't mean that China has shared strategic interests across the board. And in other ways, it's quite useful to have a country like North Korea to do the dirty work for you, to wedge drive between those alliances with the United States, with South Korea. We saw just recently in the Chinese state press extol statements from North Korean media saying that they wanted THAAD, the missile system, which was deployed controversially to South Korea in the run-up to the election to be removed. So it shows there again that there is some consonance in those interests still between North Korea and China. And I think that the North Koreans know better than anyone else how to calculate that relationship. All their existence owes to being able to play off great powers against one another, whether it's China and the United States or China and the Soviet Union in the old days. But they're playing a new and, I think, quite sophisticated version of that game now. And they have calculated that ultimately China is not going to turn off the taps of oil supply and other fundamental economic supplies into North Korea, because for the unchanging reason, they know that the Chinese fear chaos and instability across the border. They also fear a unified Korea with United States troops closing up to its land border. And I think for a leader like Xi Jinping, those interests are, I think, seen also as part of, you know, China's great power dynamic, that he is viewing this really in the round as a subset of the US-China relationship. And it's quite useful to him now that Trump has come and said, we need your help. And of course, there's a potential for a counter deal to the deal making here. And I think
no help comes for free.
Indeed.
Jill?
China can do a lot more, certainly. The North Korean trade with outside world, 90% of them is with China. Mm. And for some surprising reasons, in the past few years, North Korea's economic situation have improved. Their trade volume has gone up, mainly because of China is importing the coal from North Korea. They've also done their own, North Korea has done their own economic reform based on dollar-based market economy. Mm-hmm. So they're allowing some incentives to their workers to come up with their own, you know, productions so that they can get some incentives out of the collective production in the past. And also they allow some of the black markets in North Korea. So there are some element of the domestic, internal reform measures in the economy, but also the China's, Chinese role in having the trade relation with North Korea continuously. But they will have an impact because of this new UN Resolution 2321, which ban the limit. It's a limit on the coal export from North Korea. So we'll see how it pans out.
Right. And finally, to Australia. I mentioned earlier there was this report about Australia now being in missile range of North Korea. I mean, begs the question of why North Korea would find missile status, but leaving that to aside, I mean, what role do you think Australia has in addressing, I mean, what interest and what role do we have in addressing this particular problem? Jiyoung, maybe start with you.
Yeah, let me just quote what North Korea says about Australian Foreign Minister, who called North Korea's nuclear weapons program as a serious threat to Australia. North Korea bounced back the day after her statements of describing North Korea's nuclear program as a serious threat. It said, if North Korea persists in following the U.S. moves to isolate and stifle the...
Australia.
If Australia persists in following the U.S. moves to isolate and stifle the DPRK and remains a shock brigade of the U.S. master, this will be the suicidal act of coming within the range of nuclear strike of the strategic force of the DPRK. I don't know, to me, Australia didn't have to be the target for this nasty North Korean propaganda, didn't have to invite this kind of nasty comments when it's not a threat to Australia, to my understanding. I think Australia can do a neutral or different approach to North Korea, different from the US, I mean. If we think about the UK, for example, is the one of the first European country that set up a diplomatic relation with North Korea and has a presence in Pyongyang since then. And also Singapore, for example, it's not a government approach, but Singapore-based non-profit organization called Joseon Exchange is inviting North Koreans to teach them business skills, for example. Australia doesn't have to take side between the two Koreas. Mm-hmm. It can come up with some very innovative and neutral approach to both Koreas.
Mm. Ewan, would you agree?
No, I'd take a rather different line. I think Australia takes leadership on non-proliferation, has done historically. The non-proliferation treaty has had a coach and horses driven through it by North Korea. Again, it's another difference from some of the other proliferation cases we've seen in the world. North Korea was in the NPT. So I think that has to be borne in mind, that it's not just a solution in isolation. There is a wider international public good at stake that Australia's foreign policy has been, I think, you know, strongly attached to throughout the years. I think in reality we're not neutral because we're an ally of the United States. That will dictate a lot of the geopolitics around how Australia is involved. But not, it doesn't mean that we're a pawn in the game. It doesn't mean that we have to follow an identical approach. Australia is part of the UN command. Many of you will be aware of that, but not all, perhaps. The UN command dates back to that original 1950 resolution when a rather motley group of countries was put together to counter the North Korean invasion. And it's still important because it demonstrates that it's not just a great power issue at stake here. There is a coalition of like-minded states. And I think a country like Australia can play a different role, but one I think that, you know, clearly knows which side its bread is buttered when it comes to dealing with North Korea and the multiple threats it poses. I don't lose sleep over the North Korean missile threat to Sydney. Some advocates of missile defence have already used this to make the point that Australia should invest more in missile defence. I personally don't believe that the cost-benefit calculation has changed significantly to invest in land-based missile defence. Sea-based missile defence is a different issue. I think that's bound to happen anyway.
Can I add one last comment? To me, North Korean problem is not a Korean problem. Probably some South Korean will see this is an internal issue that, you know, international community should be out of the conversation. It's mainly, you know, our issue. But I don't think it's a Korean problem. I think it's an international problem that needs international cooperation. For example, international cooperation with Australia. And it's also not a government problem. Government cannot solve the North Korean problem. People can perhaps contribute to changing behavior in North Korean, the ordinary North Koreans, perhaps through economic exchanges and interaction with ordinary North Koreans. Let me just quote one conversation that we recently had with the high-ranking North Korean defectors in South Korea. This is what the wife of this high-ranking North Korean defector said. She said, North Koreans are already spoiled by money and capitalism. The elites know the value of money, and market economy is the one that's working. So North Korea's system is failing. But they also have to have a hope from outside world that there is an alternative solution to survive rather than sticking to Kim Jong-un.
It's a good point to turn now to the audience to take some questions. As is normally the practice, raise your hand, wait for the microphone, and then tell us who you are before asking a question.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Miller. I'm a former Australian ambassador to South Korea, dating a long way back. But in the discussion of the motives for the North Korean missile program, I think the two that were made by our speakers were international attention getting and then attending to various domestic balances and audiences within North Korea. But of course, the North Koreans themselves always point at another thing that happens in April, which are those very large military exercises between the US and South Korean armed forces. I think this year there were more than 300,000 soldiers involved in those exercises, and that they were split 50-50 between offensive manoeuvres and defensive manoeuvres. And my question is, in the various mix of motives for the missile and nuclear program, do you think there's a genuine fear and a feeling that a defence is needed or North Korea could be attacked and lacking a deterrent would suffer the fate of Iraq or Libya or so on?
Well, that's always the North Korea mindset. It's more threatening this joint military exercise by the U.S. and South Korea is more threatening to North Korea than North Korea's nuclear threat to South Korea. So that has been the official reason why they're developing these nuclear and missile programs in North Korea.
Well, I think the genuine part of it is that the North Koreans are not interested in a piece of paper in the form of a security assurance. I think they want to, if they want to engage in a freeze for freeze, it would include the ultimate goal of trying to get the US on, you know, out of South Korea. And we've seen the Chinese put a version of that proposition to the United States quite recently. And I think the United States, obviously, you know, is not prepared to bite on that. Although, where the new South Korean administration will come in, whether it's prepared to moderate the scale of some of those exercises, I wouldn't say that's impossible. Is it real? I think South Korea has already, North Korea has a very significant conventional artillery deterrent against Seoul. It's losing its military edge and has been steadily. That's part of the reason for the nuclear program, in my view, is to provide that balance against the combined capabilities of the US and South Koreans. But the reality, if you look at back, as you would know very well, Ambassador Miller, having been there that long, no one has touched the North Koreans in military terms since the end of the Korean War. They know that. And if we look at Kim Jong-un's public behavior, openly attending those exercises, those rocket launches, it doesn't look like a regime in immediate fear of decapitation. So I think they know that they have that geopolitical space to play with. Being on China's border as well is a powerful deterrent to the United States and its allies. So I think it's, you know, probably more offensively inclined.
I'm a member of the board of the Australia-Korea Foundation and also on the executive of the Australia-Korea Business Council. Could we return to the economic conversation you started with about the Korean, North Korean economy doing well at this point of time? Which seems to contradict the fact that China said, apparently contradict, that China reduced its import of coal. And that was reputed to be about 30% of North Korean exports. So that, and 90% of trade goes with China. So would you mind breaking that down? Would you also mind breaking down the energy imports from China in the context of import replacement by nuclear for oil, which of course probably can't be done solely because of the importance of diesel and military apparatus. So I'm very interested in that. The third thing I'm interested in is understanding better what actually was the South Korean reaction to the trade, the soft trade embargo, for want of a better term, that China imposed on South Korea earlier this year. What was its reaction in terms of, and I don't think Australia knows as well, what an interesting example of what might happen to us actually occurred. So that would be very interesting.
Jiang, you want to start there,
sure,
with the soft embargo?
Yeah. Before soft embargo, I want to answer to the breakdown of the contributing factor for North Korea economy is doing well. There is no consensus even among the economists or the experts what was the defining factor for North Korea's economy doing well. One is North Korea allowing the black market activity. Two is their own internal reform, economic reform measures, like I said before, giving the incentives for the workers and farmers to have their own share. Thirdly, it was the dollar base. It used to be the North Korean won-based economy. Now they are relying on U.S. dollars to run, for fixing their prices. And the rice price, there's expert sitting in this room, Justin Hastings, has done a rice price in North Korea. The rice price has been stabilized over the past few years because they switched the base currency from North Korean won to US dollars. So they are using actually US dollars as a basis for their economy. We don't know which one was a contributing factor for North Korea economies doing well rather than just relying on China. We don't normally see this internal sort of reform because that's very marginal to most of outsiders' eyes. For the soft embargo, we don't know whether it was a Chinese official policy to have this soft embargo against South Korea because of the deployment of THAAD in South Korea. But we were in South Korea just a few weeks ago, and I did a little survey in Myeongdong, the central district, stopping by 10 different shops, whether they were affected by this soft embargo. The reduced number of Chinese tourists in South Korea had a business impact on their daily lives. They all said, probably, if I'm not exaggerating, 95% of the shop owners would say, yeah, Chinese embargo has definitely have an economic impact on their income. So South Koreans are not very happy about that. But one positive thing out of this embargo is that we saw more diversified tourist group in South Korea. So we see more Southeast Asian tourists. And there was even one successful South Korean tour company that's targeting non-Chinese group for coming to South Korea and saying that enjoy Korea without the Chinese. That was the official kind of PR marketing campaign they did, and they did very well.
I'll try and answer the other parts of Georgina's question, but also second the plug for Justin Hastings, who's here in the audience, who wrote a very good book on the North Korean economy, who's at University of Sydney. On the reasons for the North Korean economy, I take the view that calling it reform is probably dignifying the North Korean authorities with effectively what is trying to put an official seal on what's already a ground-up development. When you've got an economy as repressed as North Korea, in fact, it doesn't require too much for it to grow. It's the sort of natural trajectory. I think we've just seen some of the pulling back of those obvious state levers, and rather the state is seeking its rent from that sort of natural up ground grassroots growth. In terms of China North Korea trade, the figures actually show an increase recently. Although coal was down, we see other commodities going up. I think more iron ore was purchased recently. On fuel, which is the key strategic commodity, again we see a mixed picture. Diesel went down, but jet fuel went up. So it's hardly a vote of serious economic coercion if we're beginning to see that. And I think with a lot of the other things that we see, airline services one week will be disrupted and then the next month they're expanded to a different city. So I think, China is sort of doing enough of a show that these things can be picked up by the optimists, but still it's not really a full-scale economic coercion by any stretch.
Thank you. John Dobies. I'm not affiliated with anyone. I was in Seoul 2 weeks ago, and I was really impressed how this country that 60 years ago was a bomb site is now booming, 50 million people on the up and up. And I was sort of felt very sad because over the border, there's 25 million people struggling in comparison on a much, much lower, I think I saw some figure, a 40th of the GDP per capita to what South Korea was. And it struck me that China, if it wanted to, could probably liberate North Korea tomorrow. And rather than that, it just lets it be continuously ruined by this Stalinist lunatic. And it does nothing. And my question is, it seems that the West is very happy to do trade with China and turn a completely blind eye to China's immorality in letting this Stalinist repressive regime continue. And there's no one really says too much about China doing anything about that.
I know there's some discomfort in your comment and calling North Korea as a Stalinist lunatic. Well, you don't have to borrow terms from Stalin. I mean, North Korea is its own dictator. It's its own dictator.
Own kind of lunacy.
Its own kind of lunatic, but its own kind of dictator. It had a very limited international relation with China and Russia. Now they lost all their friends in the former Soviet bloc. It has its own issues internally and externally. What China can do, but I think I would see more what North Korea can do in itself, rather than just relying on China solution to North Korean problem.
We often talk about North Korea being a buffer for China, but we shouldn't forget that it's also a buffer for South Korea. The prospect of Chinese forces closing up to the 38th parallel would also cause a great deal of unease and concern. Not just in Seoul, but internationally. I think I recall one point that a North Korean diplomat once told me that Kim Il Sung's greatest achievement was actually to secure the withdrawal of the People's Liberation Army from North Korea in the 1950s. It's not a perspective you often hear, but rather like Vietnam, the small peninsula that throughout its history has dealt with one key issue, which is how to manage its great brother to the north. The United States is the parvenu in that relationship, and that you can't change your geography. How to manage and keep a distance, China as a distance, explains, I think, a lot of North Korea's actions, whether we regard them as reprehensible or not. It's also about maintaining that survival distance against a growing power that increasingly feels like a kind of irresistible neocolonial force expressed through control of the economy and trade in North Korea.
Thank you. I'm Takiwaka, Consul General of Japan. I'd like to ask about the role of role of diplomacy, which North Korea was good at in the past. And in the past, North Korea was good at what we call salami tactics. Everything chopped into small pieces and give in some small thing in order to gain something bigger. And you know the people like Kim Kye-gang, who is an extraordinary negotiator. And they are talking about not only the what you call the hostile policy of the United States, blah, 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 but they are asking regime assurances. So they are not more interested in more in the security of that country, rather in the security of the regime itself. But nowadays, is it a valid argument or is it already obsolete nowadays? That's my single question. But before I finish, I would like to add that, Australia has contributed very intellectual manner to the matter of North Korea, namely Mr. Michael Kirby, former chair of the UN Commission on Inquiry of the Human Rights Situation of the DPRK. He is a former justice of the High Court of Australia. So you see that Australia has a not only a big physics, but also a big brains to contribute to this matters. I would like to admire. And one more thing is that, I would like to add that, regarding the nuclear possibility of the Japan, it's no option, and politically, economically, socially. And nobody is seriously thinking about the nuclear option in Japan. Thank you. So,
take the point of North Korean diplomacy. Yes, North Korea does have some very capable diplomats, and they are in a kind of unique class. They are used to dealing; they stay as specialists throughout their career, and of course, they are past masters at tough negotiations. But it's no coincidence that one of the leading defections recently was by a member of the diplomatic corps. I think that speaks to an important internal frustration that the professionals within the foreign ministry are not the real decision makers on these key issues of nuclear strategy. The foreign minister, who's a very capable diplomat, Ri Yong-ho, I wouldn't be surprised if he also shared some of those frustrations. Because the system in North Korea, you have to understand that the most powerful people often have the access to least information. That what the diplomats have is access to the information without the power. That's a very frustrating mix that they have to live with. And I think the frustration has inevitably grown because Kim Jong-un, as I said earlier, has a much higher tolerance of risk than his father. He's trying to do what his father took 20 years to establish himself in two, or maybe slightly longer. And that carries huge risks. And I think the worldly rational face of North Korea, including some of its more capable diplomats, are behind the scenes increasingly frustrated by the straitjacket that imposes on them.
Well, North Korea, they either sacked or executed all the softliner within the cabinet. I had some hope, little hope, when Jang Song-taek, who's the uncle of Kim Jong-un, was alive. But I totally lost there was any hope in the North Korean regime when he killed his own uncle. It's very un-Korean to kill your uncle in that manner, very brutal manner. So all the softliners, the reform-minded people are purged, and purge is still going on. And we see this series of defection from North Korea.
Anthony, you introduced this discussion by talking about least bad options. And in Iran, the least bad option was to negotiate a deal. My question is the least bad option here an attack on North Korea? Because what I think we're hearing is that Kim Jong-un will not back down. And the US has got a lot of credibility at stake. And also, it's not only just the short-term nuclear capability, it's what North Korea might do with nuclear weapons in terms of international trade in the future. So, I mean, is the least bad option here different from the Iranian situation?
You saved the easiest question till last. It's a question that has to be asked. The all options on the table speaks implicitly to that last option. In my view, the all options on the table was interpreted out of all context to the likelihood that the US was actually going down that path. But we have a peculiar political dynamic where we've got President Trump, who during his four-year term, if he lasts that long, is going to have to grapple with the likelihood that North Korea will get over that threshold. No American president would want that on their watch, regardless of their personality or however much they're focused on this singular issue. Although I think it's bluster now, it's not to say it couldn't come back. And there is, I think, a reverse risk now that if the North Koreans, and perhaps with Chinese encouragement, regard this as bluster on the US's part, will Kim Jong-un overstep the line in an act of provocation towards South Korea or directly towards the United States? Now, they're rational, but he's a young man. He's got a high tolerance of risk. I think that could trigger conflict. But to enter into an elective unilateral military operation, given the extreme practical difficulty of actually carrying out the mission to take out all of that nuclear capability, given how it's been dispersed, well hidden, and the big strategic unknown factor of how China would react to that. Now, China's been signaling in various ways that it might not necessarily oppose a strike if there wasn't ground forces introduced. But then look at what's the position in South Korea. You've got 150,000 Americans resident, large numbers of foreigners living within artillery range in Seoul. It may not be the Gotterdammerung that sometimes people think it is, but it certainly wouldn't be cheap. It wouldn't be, it would be bloody. It would be unpredictable. I think it's still in the shadow of Iraq. It's unrealistic, I think, to expect the United States, given that it's elected a president to avoid those kinds of foreign entrapments, would do so. It would only happen, I think, if the North Koreans overstep the line.
To me, military attack is not an option in the Korean Peninsula. South Koreans cannot afford the sudden collapse of the North Korean regime. I think that's what Kim Dae-jung prepared for this sunshine policy, the gradual sort of eating up North Korean through economic engagement and cultural exchanges between the two Koreas. It's not easy. Dealing with North Korea would require an enormous amount of patience. It will be very, very slow. But South Korea has its own issues as in socioeconomic terms. You know, it has very high unemployment rates there. It's a very high competition for every aspect of the society. I think our problem is to focus too much on the capability side, but also the bigger issue. To me, North Korea's biggest crime is banning access to its own people access to information. And also the nature of a regime, it's not about the nuclear capability, but also they have conducted illicit activities by counterfeiting and drug trafficking, and human rights violation is one. So perhaps we can focus on the nature of the regime and what we as an international community can do about it.
Very, very briefly, I think the way that If there's a way in which the North Korean situation will be solved, pressure does play a part of that, but it will be someone internally moving against Kim Jong-un. I think that's, in that sense, external pressure and a military component to that can be a positive force. Because once the economic squeeze removes the patronage network that keeps Kim Jong-un, the only ability he has to maintain elite control is that access to resources. If those resources are squeezed through a combination of Chinese and US pressure, then I think there may be a movement against him. At that point, you could find we are in a different scenario if he's taken out by the generals around him. But I think a military move to do so, to my mind, unilaterally is an unacceptable cost.
Ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, it's time to bring our session today to a close. I'm sure you'll agree with me, it's been really interesting and informative. It's not an issue that's going to go away, and therefore I'm sure we'll be back on this stage soon, maybe even talking about it once again. Please join me in thanking Ewan and Jill.